All right. Well, welcome to the next edition to our monthly speaker series here. My name is John Patika Jr. with the Patika Wealth Management Group, and I'm accompanied with our senior partner and father, John Patika Sr. And we've got a lot to cover today with the markets, from market volatility, inflation, Ukraine. And I think we just got to get right at it and introduce our speaker, which his name is Mike Ryan. Mike is a divisional vice chairman for UBS Global Wealth Management. Mike has previously, he led our 50 U.S.-based research professionals as our chief investment officer, Americas, for UBS Global Wealth Management, and has also served on the Global Investment Committee, which is responsible for formulating the U.S. Global Wealth Management Investment House View. Mike's had more than 35 years of experience in the financial industry and is widely recognized as a leading market expert. So, Mike, welcome to the call.
John, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Mike, it's John Sr. Since, you know, back in our old Payne Weber days, whenever things got a little volatile or confusing, I'd follow your stuff, especially on the fixed income side and our cash and stuff every day for clarity. And well, here we are again. So
yeah, kind of back to the future, isn't it, John?
Yeah, it seems like it always repeats every few years. But look, you've always had a steady hand. I'm so glad you could join us, and let's get right to it. You know, markets are volatile. How about walking us through some of the issues and just get us started with that?
Let me kind of focus on the volatility and then what I think that what I'll call the causal agents, what it is that's driving this current volatility. Let's start with the notion that we've just gone through a period of extraordinary low volatility. You know, if you think about it really from March of 2020, when the market bottomed out amid the initial surge in the COVID virus, to December of last year, you had almost this uninterrupted rise in equity markets, very, very low interest rate environment. You know, markets in general were doing well. And we had very, very few drawdowns or periods of volatility. So I think what we're actually experiencing now is not abnormal at all. In fact, it's somewhat to be expected. But I do think it's after coming from such an extended period where markets were rallying sharply, I think it's unsettled people. So I think we have to look at, again, John, what are the sources of what's driving the volatility? And I'll break them into four broad categories. And then as in the rest of our conversation, maybe we'll explore them a little more deeply. I think the first one is clearly what I'll call the macro landscape, the economy. And I think it falls in two camps there. One is concerns about growth. Are we now seeing this deceleration in growth? And the concern, of course, is this not just a moderation of the expansion, but is it perhaps a sign that we're now entering the ending phase of the business cycle and entering recession? So I think that's the first thing on the macro side. The other aspect, of course, is we're faced with the most serious inflation threat we've had in 40 years. And concerns, of course, is something we haven't seen in a while. And how do we manage through that? So that's kind of the macro side of it. I think the second aspect that we're dealing with as well is its policy inflection point. You know, related to this rise in inflation, the Fed is now in the process of resetting policy. You know, we've had this unprecedented policy response, first to the global financial crisis, and then more recently to COVID-19. And now the Fed has to begin to walk that back simply because the policy mix that was put in place is simply unsustainable. And markets are concerned about how quickly and how aggressively the Fed will have to shrink the balance sheet and also reset rates. So I certainly think policy has been a second element here. Let's also not kid ourselves. The third element here is geopolitics. We went through an extended period where the dominance of the U.S. on the world scene meant that we had the ability to protect and project. It also meant that U.S. was, you know, the ascendance of, or the primacy rather, of the U.S. power, also coincided with what I call the triumph of capitalism and the expansion of free markets around the world. And now we're seeing is that primacy is being challenged and that notion about global access to free markets is being questioned. And obviously the hotspot right now is the Ukraine, what we're seeing in terms of Russia's ambition and aggressiveness, but also the fact that you have other players, whether it's China, whether it's belligerent states like North Korea and potentially even Iran. This has become certainly a more complicated world. And I think what the markets are now focused on is, okay, geopolitics have re-entered the stage as a potential issue that's going to undermine or certainly be an additive worry for markets. And I think the last element is here, John, is a biological one. Even though we've made significant progress in the ongoing battle with COVID, it's still with us. The pandemic is not been a race that hasn't been eradicated. You know, the hope is that it's now shifting from the pandemic to the endemic phase of this virus. But we're reminded in the recent shutdowns in China that we'll still have a disruptive impact in terms of the global economy and potentially in markets as well. So I think the markets have to adjust all four of those pretty meaty issues. And that's why I think we're getting the volatility that we've seen really since the beginning of the year, but more acutely over the course of the last 2 months.
Hey, Mike, let's stay on the geopolitics while we're there. Look, my heart goes out to those people. Of course, everybody does. But as an advisor, I need to assess all of this stuff, the economic fallout and the potential impact that those two countries have on our markets. And I need your thoughts on that. You know, everybody knows the facts about wheat and all of that, but tell me how that's going to affect it.
Well, John, first of all, I think the first comment you made is the most appropriate one, in that, look, war is always horrible. This is a humanitarian crisis, and what we're seeing is this act of naked aggression against the Ukraine and the response of the Ukrainian people, but also the atrocities being committed. These are things that we hoped we'd never see again in our lifetime, but obviously we are seeing them. So to your comment, you know, our hearts do go out for the people of Ukraine and those who would be impacted by this. So, but I also understand your point about we as investors need to step away from the human element of this, and then we have to start looking at this a little bit through a different lens and understand, okay, what are the macro and market implications. And I think the way you need to look at this then is what we call first order, second order, and third order effects. So let me focus first on the first order effects. So the first order effects are the economic damage and dislocation to the belligerents themselves. So when you think about Russia, the estimates are that this already is likely to cause a 10 to 15% contraction in the Russian economy just because of the impact of sanctions, the isolation of Russia from, you know, credit and capital markets, and also the disruption of economic activity because of the mobilization for war. So clearly this is going to have a direct impact. I actually think that's just the tipping point. I think what you're going to see is this will affect the Russian economy for years to come for two reasons. One is they're going to have a real tough time now accessing credit. There's, you know, if you think about what's happening, the isolation of Russia, the closing off of credit and capital markets means it's going to be harder and harder for Russia to raise money on global markets. Certainly, if we see a series of defaults on their sovereign debt, that's not going to make it any easier. But then the other aspect, which may be even more important, is the withdrawal of Western technologies. Western technologies are really important to Russia's economy. And when you put those two together, the absence of capital and also the fact that we're not going to see, you know, the ability to use Western technology, there's some estimates that this could set the Russian economy back a decade or more. When you look at this in retrospect, this may be one of the greatest self-inflicted economic wounds that any leader has ever imposed upon his country. So clearly for Russia, this is a significant, even potentially devastating event. For the Ukraine, it's even more severe. You know, we're talking about, at least in the near term, the economy contracting over 40%. And that's probably a conservative estimate. I'd say it could be even as much as 50 to 60% when all is said and done. The devastation that they're having to deal with is just, it's heartbreaking to see. And by the way, the economic activity we are seeing is largely towards addressing military needs, refugee relief, the notion about maintaining essential services. So those are the things we are seeing, economic activity, but that doesn't pay huge long-term productive gains. So when you look at those two economies, they're going to be devastated. But let's also put that in context. When you put them together, they represent less than 3% of global GDP. So it's not enough. The first order effects are certainly not enough to cause a recession or certainly not trigger a bear market. So then what we really need to think more acutely of is what we call these second order effects. And this is where I think there is much more fallout. This is the ripple effects that you get from the increase in energy prices, the effects that sanctions have, not just on Russia, but also on other states, for example, banks that are impacted by that as well. And then you mentioned this notion about wheat production. Remember, Ukraine is an important agricultural state. Historically, it was known as the breadbasket of the Soviet Union. So the disruption to planting and the harvest season and the loss of at least one, arguably two or three seasons of crops, this is going to have an impact on global food prices as well. So you can start to see now these ripple effects that we see now from the collateral damage. The third order effects are the ones that are perhaps most concerning, but I put it as the lowest probability, and that is a proliferation into NATO. That's the risk that we see now, systemic risks being embedded in the markets, potentially even a movement towards the use of nuclear weapons. You know, that's sort of the worst case scenario. I think what we're going to be dealing with then, John, is the first and second order effects, and we have to gauge how those are impacting. Again, our view is it's going to be disruptive, but it's not enough to throw the global economy into recession, nor is it enough by itself to trigger a bear market.
Let's take it back here for a minute. The Fed's begun its monetary policy changes, and then you're hearing comments that they might accelerate the process, balance sheet, interest rates. How do you think all that's going to play out?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. When you ask me about the things that, you know, concern me the most, I actually think recession risks are not the thing I'm most worried about. Look, we have a pretty healthy economy. You know, we are slowing, and it's clearly being, you know, it's a lower pace of growth. But, you know, usually you don't get recessions when you have employment rates that are falling, industrial production that's strong, you know, ISM readings that are over 50%. That's just not the hallmarks of an economy that's falling to recession, especially with consumers in such good shape. What I am more worried about, though, is the Fed's response function to inflation. Look, one of the things that we talked about is the fact that, you know, price pressures are at some of the highest levels seen in 40 years. And I think initially the Fed was a bit dismissive of those inflation pressures. They viewed them as transitory. That's a word you heard so much used in 2021. And that was a recognition that more of this now is structural and probably a little bit stickier. So now we have to understand, okay, well, how the Fed responds to that. Now, the problem with this, John, is remember, the Fed policy is always an inexact science, and it's not easy to do. The notion that central banks can just easily, deftly shift policy whenever it's appropriate, it just doesn't work that way. You know, it's a blunt instrument, and they deal in a world of uncertainty. This is not an exact science. I think it's complicated by the fact that you're trying to step away from an unprecedented policy response, and you're doing it while we're still confronted with a war. We're faced with the highest inflation in 40 years. Oh, and by the way, we're still in the midst of a pandemic. That's a pretty tight quarter the Fed has to navigate. So what they have to make sure they're doing is they're appropriately resetting policy to make sure inflation pressures don't continue to build and that the inflation expectations don't run away. But they can't do it so quickly or so aggressively that they actually wind up undermining the expansion itself and throwing us into recession. So this is the area we'll be watching really, really closely and really carefully, John. And what we'll be looking for here is signs that inflation is beginning to bend. We actually think inflation may well have peaked in the last inflation report and begin to slowly for the next couple of months, but it'll be important to see that. And then how the Fed's reaction function in response to that is. Again, if inflation doesn't moderate the way we're expecting, and the Fed actually has to continue not only to raise rates, but even amplify and increase the magnitude of those rates, that's the thing I'm most concerned about. Again, I don't think the most likely scenario is that they have to step it up aggressively, but it's something we can't rule out. And a lot of it hinges on how quickly and how far inflation pressures moderate.
Mike, don't we see a lot of this stuff being already solved for the Fed? You know, mortgages, I saw the 30-year mortgage over 5%, things like that. I mean, isn't some of this just being solved because of the weight of the inflation and higher rates?
It is, John. You know, it's interesting. There's two things that we tend to see. There's tightening by the Fed, which is when the Fed, you know, actually raises official rates. But there's actually something called tightening of financial conditions. And that's sort of when the market does a lot of the heavy lifting for the Fed. So, for example, when you have market volatility like we're witnessing right now, when we have rates rising, which we talked about, you know, market rates, when credit spreads begin to widen, all of those things help dampen growth and actually, you know, contribute to, you know, the slowing of the economy that the Fed's looking to do. So to me, I think you're right here. I think the markets are responding to what they anticipate the Fed doing. And I think therefore some of the Fed's job is being done for it. But the notion that the Fed can just trust the market to do the adjustment, I don't think it works that way, because as soon as they got the expectation that the Fed is going to stop raising rates, you know, then confidence in the Fed's ability to control inflation comes into question. So I think the Fed still needs to follow through. And I think the next couple of months is going to be really important with regard to how successful the Fed is and what the perceptions are of inflation.
Mike, I aged in the 1970s, Pittsburgh, and we had, you know, really high inflation, but we had high unemployment. This is high inflation and really low unemployment. How does that play out? How's that supposed to happen? I mean, it's not going to be a recession. I mean, is that why you're not as fearful of a recession? Is that it?
Yeah. So, John, by the way, I also grew up in the 70s. And in the 70s, I had maybe one of the best jobs you could have as a high school kid. I was a gas station attendant. And what we used to do is we put the sign on the last car. And one of the things you do is people would come and pay you to put it on their last car. So it was a pretty lucrative role for me in high school as an entrepreneur, even then, dealing with gas lines. But obviously what you're talking about was the worst combination is a recession coupled with surging inflation. And that's really the worst environment, not only economically, but also from financial market perspective, because not only are companies dealing with higher prices, but they're also seeing aggregate demand fall, demand decline for their products. And that's why, equities did so poorly in the 70s, because we had that really horrible combination. I don't see a stagflation environment manifesting itself now. First of all, I don't think inflation's at the same level that we had in the 1970s. That stubbornly entrenched inflation that was contributed to by, OPEC and some of the other policies. I also think that, as I said before, growth is pretty resilient right now. So I think recession risks are pretty low. Now, look, I don't rule out or completely, throw away the risk of that we could see stagflation, but I don't think that's the base case of the most likely scenario. So I don't look for a repeat of the bad old days of the mid to late 1970s. Instead, what I look to see is a challenging period, but I actually think that equity markets can grind higher over the course of this year and into at least early next year.
And I remember guys like you running out in front of my car saying, "No more gas, we're closing." I remember those guys, not real popular. Mike, inverted yield curve, you hear so much about. Is there truth to that? The 2 and the 10, they make such a big deal out of that. How does that work?
So this is, I'll make an absolutely factually true statement. I think it's also misleading. So the true statement is that virtually every recession has been preceded by an inversion in the yield curve. So an inversion yield curve, just to help everybody understand it, an inversion yield curve is that when long rates actually fall below short-term rates. That is, you have, the two-year note, maybe at 3%, and you have the 10-year note, say, at 2.5%. That's an inversion of the yield curve, a downwardly sloping curve. So it is true that all recessions have been preceded by a flattening or an inversion yield curve. What's not true is that every flattening or inversion of the yield curve is followed by a recession. That's not true. There's an old saying that inverted yield curves have forecasted 11 of the last 3 recessions, because what happens is yield curves invert for lots of reasons. They can invert because of lack of supply. They can invert short term because of technicals, because of demand. So there's lots of reasons why yield curves can invert. I also want to maybe even take that term inversion, the yield curve, and pick that apart, because I think that term is thrown around so liberally. We have not seen an inversion in the yield curve. What you actually had was one part of the yield curve spread between, I think it was 2s and 5s, and then 5s and 10s. There was about a 3 or 4 basis point difference where longer rates traded below short-term rates. That's a flat yield curve. That's not an inverted yield curve. An inverted yield curve is when you have longer-term rates are materially below short-term rates for a sustained period of time. We don't have that. We don't see that. In fact, the yield curve is actually re-steepened. So the notion that this yield curve is forecasting recession, first of all, I'm always skeptical of that anyway, because that's not what the yield curve does. It doesn't predict or doesn't cause recessions. And then secondly, to the extent it does have any communicative power or signaling power, it requires that this inversion has to be deeper and more long-lasting.
Hey, Mike, what do we do here? Where do you see the biggest risks? Where do you see the biggest opportunities? I know there's a lot of ways for this to play out, but tell me 2 of them. Where's the risk? Where's the opportunity?
So let me start with the risks in the near term. So I still think, what I'll call the sectors of the market that are still most sensitive to rising rates are probably going to be the areas that are going to be faced with some of the biggest risks. So that's why you've seen growth stocks perform so poorly. A lot of people don't look at growth stocks as being rate sensitive equities. But what drives growth stocks is they usually do really well in low growth, low inflation, falling interest rate environments. And therefore, in a fairly strong growth environment, higher inflation, rising interest rates, they don't do well. So that rising rate environment has really been a significant hit to grow stocks. And by the way, that comes off of a really long extended period of outperformance of growth stocks. So I do think at least in the near term, you're going to see markets sort of searching for a level that they're comfortable with on growth stocks. So I think growth stocks are probably going to remain under pressure. Part of the reason why we prefer value right now. I think there, from a sector standpoint, there's some exposure here as well. You know, when you think about which sectors are going to be more acutely affected, the performance across equity markets is not uniform. When we think about the equity sectors, for example, you know, utilities are an area that has historically not performed as well when rates are rising. Now, I think utilities have already priced a lot in. They really did poorly over the course of the last couple of months, so we're not as negative on that. But I do think that the fixed income part of our portfolio, we still have to be a bit cautious here and not be too long maturity or what we call high duration, because I still think there's some repricing there. So those are kind of the areas that I'm more concerned about from a near-term perspective, John.
You may have answered most of this question, but or in the past, you've always written about the possible, the probable, and the plausible. Talk about that maybe a little bit. Finish up with maybe you missed.
By the way, I kind of only partially answered your last question. Let me complete that. You also asked me what the opportunities were, and I was kind of dwelling on the risks. And I certainly want to leave that as the lead behind. So I do think, look, I think markets can grind higher over the balance this year, as long as we avoid recession, as long as the Fed doesn't have to over-respond to inflation. I'm pretty confident in the growth side. Again, inflation still, we need to see more evidence of that. And then once we see that, I think the markets can go through this recovery process and, you know, probably finish the year probably closer to 4,700. Today, we closed just below 4,400. So I think there's some upside in the markets. But I also think it's going to be selective. I think we've pivoted away from the what I call the pure cyclicals that worked really well in the early and sort of middle stages in the business cycle. Now, as we're getting a bit mature in the business cycle, we want to rotate a bit. We still think energy is going to benefit from these, you know, elevated energy prices and, you know, continued solid global demand. But we also have now moved to an overweight on healthcare, because I think that's one of the more defensive sectors that tends to hold up well in periods of volatility. I also think, even though I talked, John, about the fact that currently we don't see growth stocks performing well, and I'm concerned in the near term about growth stocks, I also have to recognize, of course, that there are some real transformational technologies that are going to have an enormous potential to generate growth over the next 5 and 10 years. So while you don't want to be over allocated or heavily weighted to growth stocks right now, you also need to maintain presence in these, what I'll call these secular drivers of long-term growth. You know, things like what we're seeing in terms of AI and robotics, biomedical engineering, the whole notion about big data and how we use that. Think about what's happening in terms of mobility in the cloud, advanced material design. These are all transformative technologies that will generate incredible wealth over the course of the next 5 to 10 years. So you still need to have some presence there. So when I talk about being de-emphasizing growth stocks, it doesn't mean abandoning those long-term growers. Going back to the question you actually directed to me, John, I look across the continuum. And I think what happens is we tend to get overly focused on the possible. So the way I kind of look at the world, it goes across the spectrum. It's the possible, the plausible, the probable, and the preferable. And I think we have to do is we have to, first of all, let's throw out the preferable. We don't get to live in the world that we choose. Yeah, I'd love to see markets up 20-25% this year. I'd love to see rates going down. I'd love to see no volatility, but that's not realistic. So throw out the preferable. I also think you have to be a little bit careful about overemphasizing the possible, because there's lots of possible things that can happen. I think sometimes we start to pull in all of these potential risks, and it kind of frees us investors. We have to traffic in, John, is that domain of the plausible and the probable. And to me, I think, you know, what's plausible is that we will likely see some more volatility. I think growth is going to be challenged on a couple of fronts. Inflation will be sticky. But I think what's most probable is that the expansion will endure. Inflation pressures will recede as some of the supply chain bottlenecks begin to ease. And I think the Fed will be able to respond in a more measured manner going forward. So I think I want to traffic in that plausible to probable range rather than the possible and the preferable, because I just don't find them to be very helpful. Maybe the last thing I'll say on this, John, is when people tell me, well, Mike, you know, there's all these things to worry about and all these risks, and isn't this the worst environment to invest, and shouldn't I just sit on the sidelines? I always challenge people to go back and pick a date, almost arbitrarily, pick any date, any week, in any year. And then go back and look at the headlines and all the things that potentially go wrong, all the things that we worry about. And what you find is that many of them, in fact, most of them, don't transpire into the worst case scenarios. And if we simply take our investment cues from the worst case scenario that could possibly happen, I think that's where we commit some of our biggest mistakes as investors. So let's do a fair assessment. Let's look at what's the probable and the plausible, and then make informed investment choices that way.
A couple of quick ones. Politics. Now, if whatever the common, maybe it's common sense, the Republicans take over the House and maybe the Senate, how does that affect any of this macro view that you have?
Not a lot. At the end of the day, we have such a narrow margin that the Democrats have in Congress that there's not a whole lot they can do right now, especially with a few Democratic senators who seem to be balking at the legislative agenda that's been put forth by the White House. So to me, and by the way, you know, the notion that you're going to get a lot done, you know, we're in April in election year. You know, really, once you get into May, they're working on getting themselves reelected and they're not really working on the nation's business. And the notion that they're going to either pass some kind of a tax increase or some of that, I think you have to, the probability of legislation getting passed goes down exponentially as you get closer to the election. So to me, I don't think a whole lot's going to happen in the near term period. Now, obviously, when we talk about the midterm elections, if it were to happen right now, look, still a lot can happen between now and November. If the election be held today, it's almost a certainty that the Democrats will lose the House. I will tell you that the Senate's still a toss-up. And the reason is not that Democrats are particularly polling well. It's just that the math works against the Republicans. There's more Republican seats up. There's more Republicans retiring. And therefore, to turn what they need to defend and also flip to gain control of the Senate. Remember, only a third of the Senate is up in any two-year cycle. So it's not like the whole Senate turns over. It's just a third of it. So it's harder to flip the Senate than it is the House. I'd say that's really going to be a jump ball, a close call. But what's likely to happen then is you will get divided government. If the Republicans take just one House of Congress, it means Congress is split, and it means then the legislative agenda comes to a virtual screeching halt. So the administration will try and do things through executive orders. They'll try and get things pushed that way. But you won't see anything meaningfully happening on the legislative agenda until the next presidential election cycle. So what we'll be entering is gridlock. Now, by the way, gridlock is, there's nothing wrong with gridlock. In fact, gridlock is often the good for markets. What is not good, though, John, is when gridlock devolves into dysfunction. There are things we actually need elected officials in Washington to do. We need them to raise debt ceilings. We need them to pass budget and appropriation bills. We need them to address issues that are critically important, like defense issues and immigration. So the things we need them to do. So again, there's nothing wrong with gridlock, but you always want to be careful about that devolving into pure dysfunction.
And finally, look, all of our clients are wealthy already. How do we keep them there? Where should I position just normal investors?
So first of all, what I will say is how we've always viewed our role and seen ourselves is as the stewards of wealth. And stewardship is a responsibility we take seriously. But remember that stewardship is meant to be something that is an evergreen concept. It's not just about today or tomorrow. This is something about how we preserve, protect, and build wealth over a lifetime or even multiple generations. So we need to think about, okay, how do we structure portfolios appropriately? So the first thing I would say is having really, really well articulated and carefully and clearly defined financial plan is absolutely table stakes. It's a starting point. Once you have a plan in place, then you structure portfolios appropriately. It means you have what we call a strategic asset allocation that's really well balanced, diversified across different asset classes. And that gives you the ability then to make sure that when we do have market dislocations, you're not completely exposed to industry, a company, an asset class, or even an individual stock. So diversification is still one of the most important concepts of investors. And lastly, it's making sure that we do pivot portfolios appropriately to where we are in the business, the policy, and the investing cycle. So it's making sure that when we see risks within, say, different sectors, we underweight those sectors. It means that when we're concerned about rates, we shorten duration or limit our maturities so that we're not overexposed. So there's lots we can do to set the portfolio long-term up for success, but there's also things we could do in the short term to avoid some of the pitfalls and misfortunes that happen throughout a business cycle.
Mike, any final thoughts on the macro? We miss anything?
No, I think we covered it all, John. I think the one thing, maybe I'll close with this on recessions, because I think that's where a lot of focus is. So remember that recessions are actually relatively rare. They don't happen all that often. And when you look at any particular year, there's always about a 20% probability of recession. So if you take that as context, then, okay, a recession can happen, you know, there's a 1 in 5 chance any year that we can have a recession. But obviously, it's not just probability games. It's not just a roll of the dice. The conditions that you see will determine that probability. Now, right now, I actually see, despite all the hand-wringing concerns, I actually see the recession risks right now are actually below 20%. I probably put them closer to 15%. So again, I think it's a year where we will have growth slow. There will be some challenges. But as I said before, you don't usually see recessions when you have more companies seeking workers than you have individuals seeking jobs. You don't typically see recessions when you have consumer wealth has increased by $2.5 trillion. You don't typically see recessions when business investment spending is accelerating by about 15% pace. So these are not the hallmarks or the characteristics of recession. So again, this is probably one of the areas where I'm less concerned about is this notion about recession.
Awesome. Well, this is John Jr., Mike, and we're running close here to the end of the call. And we really appreciate your time and spending with us and the conversation. I know we went through a lot of things, but thank you so much.
Thank you, Mike.
So that concludes the end of the call. Everyone be safe. And remember, there'll be a recording on our website and you'll be able to access this recording and this call on Spotify and our website. So everyone take care. And this is the conclusion of the call.